their NPR member stations, and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, GTE, where the power is on for telecommunications, lighting, and precision materials, WCPN, Cleveland Public Radio Fund for News Excellence, and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues. This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or the broadcast station.
From National Public Radio, this is another in a series of programs from the National Press Club. In Washington, I'm John Ogulnick. Today's guest speaker is Secretary of Transportation Samuel Skinner. When he was appointed by President Bush, Mr. Skinner was one of the least known cabinet appointees. That changed quickly, however, as the Eastern airstrike thrust the secretary into the spotlight early in his tenure in office. Mr. Skinner has also been actively involved in the Alaska oil spill, traveling to Valdez to get a first-hand look at the damage. A former transportation official in his home state of Illinois, the secretary was known in Chicago as Sam the Hammer, a moniker he earned as a tough federal prosecutor. Today, Mr. Skinner will talk about airline security, a topic he discussed with officials on a recent trip to Europe. Now here's Peter Holmes, president of the National Press Club.
Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Peter Holmes. I'm an assistant managing editor of the Washington Times, and I'm this year's club president. I'd like to welcome today's audiences, press club members and their guests, here in the ballroom of the National Press Club in the National Press Building in downtown Washington, D.C., listeners on the National Public Radio Network, and viewers on C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. I'd like to bring to your attention some upcoming club events that may be of interest. This Friday, May 5th, our guest will be the Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland. On June 5th, President Gerald Ford will be here to present the Gerald R. Ford Journalism Awards for distinguished reporting on defense and the presidency. On June 14th, our guest will be the Chinese Foreign Minister, Chen Qian, National Gallery of Art Director, J. Carter Brown, on June 20th, and Australian Prime Minister, Robert Hawke, on June 26th. I'd like to remind those in the ballroom that if you have questions for today's speaker, and I trust you will, please write them on the cards on your table provided for that purpose and pass them up. I will ask as many as time permits. Now I would like to introduce today's head table guests. I ask that you withhold your applause until all have been announced. On my left at the east end of the ballroom is Jim Ott of Aviation Week. Jim Wolf, Reuters News Service. John Cushman, New York Times. David Field, Washington Times, and the organizer of today's luncheon. Don Byrne, Associate Editor of Traffic World and former National Press Club President. The Honorable Elaine Chao, Deputy Secretary of Transportation. To my right, at the west end of the ballroom, James Carroll, Knight Ridder Newspapers. Howard Abramson, Journal of Commerce. Seth Payne, Business Week. John Gaughan, the Department of Transportation Chief of Staff. John Peterson of the Detroit News and member of the Press Club's Board of Governors. Ed Prina, former Copley Bureau Chief and Chairman of the Club Speakers Committee. And to Ed's left and to my right is today's guest, the Secretary of Transportation, Samuel Skinner. Last November, one of the first names to service as a cabinet nominee was that of a Chicago lawyer and transit official named Sam Skinner. Secretary Skinner wasn't shy about making his name known, and let it be known he had little fear of publicity. He got it. On December 21st, a Pan Am jumbo jet dropped from the skies over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing 256. The next day, President Bush nominated Mr. Skinner to be Secretary of Transportation. As the accident investigation pointed to the hand of terrorism, the spotlight focused on Secretary Skinner. He remained center stage as Eastern Airlines and its unions headed toward a showdown. When President Bush refused to intervene in that labor dispute, Secretary Skinner was the point man again. becoming the administration spokesman on a crisis that filled headlines but emptied airports for weeks. Before the picketers at Eastern suffered their first calluses, though, Secretary Skinner entered the news again as the Exxon Valdez hit the shoals of Prince William Sound. As the Wall Street Journal put it recently, he's become the administration's pinch hitter. Perhaps that stems from his background in Chicago politics, where he rode herd on the various jurisdictions that make up one of the nation's largest commuter systems. While chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority of Northeastern Illinois, Secretary Skinner also practiced law, a natural progression from his days as United States Attorney there. He has served on the various requisite boards and commissions, but much to the delight of the transportation community, he also flies his own plane. Secretary Skinner has just returned from a mission to 7 European capitals, where he met with aviation authorities on improving airport security. Since security and the fight against terrorism have occupied him from his very first day on the job, it seems appropriate that he is here today to give us some important news. Please join me in giving Secretary Skinner a warm press club welcome.
Well, that's quite an introduction. It's like the other day when I walked in to see the president on what is another crisis, and he turned to me and he said, "You know, we had a great transportation system in this country till I selected you." I hope he means that with a sense of humor. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I must say that you're right, being with the press is not new to me. As United States Attorney in a very high-profile office, I was required by my position to interface with the press on a regular basis. And, of course, in the private sector as a lawyer for Sidley and Austin, I had the opportunity to serve as general counsel for a period of years for the Chicago Sun-Times. So I think that that, combined with a lifelong respect for the press and the role of the press, has allowed me to communicate with the press and to the American people on issues of vital importance to them in the area of transportation, and to do so without fear or without any real concerns, because if you can work with the press over an extended period of time in Chicago, we say you can work with the press anywhere in the world. It is an interesting time for transportation in this country. It's ironic that as we focus on the various jobs in government, one of the jobs that we probably least focused on, at least until recently, is the Secretary of Transportation, the Department of Transportation, and the role that it plays. Yet, it is one of the most vital departments in our government. Our government's economy and our ability to compete worldwide is determined greatly by the way our transportation system functions and how effective it is in the international markets that we deal with. It is ironic that the day after the Pan Am 103 tragedy occurred that the president would announce my nomination, because there has been no issue that I have been obsessed with more as Secretary of Transportation than the act of airline security and aviation security in general. That thought and obsession really struck home when I had the opportunity to meet with the families of the Pan Am 103 victims a couple of months ago. It is very difficult to describe that meeting. You are speechless as you're introduced to fathers, mothers, sons, wives, and to try to explain what happened, why it happened, and what can be done to prevent it from happening again. It was that meeting and the meeting that our president held with the families shortly thereafter that has given the Department of Transportation the resolve to deal with this issue of aviation security. I just returned from a 5-day six-nation visit to Europe to discuss aviation security issues throughout Europe. I met with my counterparts, the ministers of transport in Italy, Germany, Switzerland, France, and the United Kingdom, met with the interior ministers of those countries as well on some occasions, met with the airline heads, met with another family victim who was kind of in between. She's a British citizen. Her husband was a United States citizen, and she's part of neither group. So we asked her to meet with the new ambassador to Great Britain and myself to discuss the whole problem of aviation security. And it was on the basis of the preparation for that trip that I anticipated that we would receive a somewhat positive response. But as a Chicago lawyer and former prosecutor, I am not the most experienced in international affairs. Some would say the real risk of sending me over is like sending the bull into the china shop. And my impatience on issues I was concerned might get in the way of diplomacy in the ways that things are done in the global world. Well, much to my delight, I was received as the representative of the United States of America in every country with the utmost courtesy. Every transport minister I met with shared my concern that we do something about the problems of terrorism and committed to me to work with us in dealing with these problems. Once I explained to them that I understood that if we're going to solve the problem of international terrorism as it relates to aviation safety, we must work together and not alone, and that I was willing to work with them and share our technology and our expertise with them, they couldn't have been nicer. In a time when one expects the United States to be treated sometime with a little concern or disdain in the world, it was awfully nice to see that the respect that each one of those countries have for the United States and for our Department of Transportation and what we're doing. But more important, it was very heartening on behalf of those families to receive the kind of commitment and support I received in every part of the world. The problem of terrorism and aviation terrorism is not over. It is a long-standing problem, a much complicated problem. And if something's going to be done about this, as I've indicated earlier, it must be a unified commitment by government, by industry, and by the traveling public. We are in this for the long haul. The progress we made last week in Europe is just the beginning. It will be a project and a priority within my administration and the President's administration as long as we are here. The President is totally committed to my efforts. He not only met with the families of the Pan Am 103 victims, but immediately put into place a number of steps in the area of intelligence gathering, in the area of dealing with families, as well as dealing with these problems that are already paying dividends. I, as his point man, am totally committed as well, and I look forward to carrying out his program and his objectives. I want to emphasize, before I talk about a couple of specifics, that aviation travel is still one of the safest forms of travel in the world. If you look at any statistic that you come up with, you will see that aviation travel is extremely safe. And travel on American flag carriers is even safer because of the steps they are taking on terrorism. Many of you may have heard that there's been some concern on safety and among American corporations. One corporation in particular issued a travel advisory. And when I got on the flight back from London Thursday, I was delighted to see two things. Number one, the American flag carrier I was flying on was full, and people were waiting to get on. Number two, sitting next to me were two senior executives of that same corporation that had issued that travel advisory. I think their recognition and our recognition and the American people's recognition that a number of steps taken by the airlines and the Federal Aviation Administration and the Department of Transportation have made significant strides in tightening up security, not only here but abroad. And I'm delighted to see that. I'm delighted with the progress that we've made. We will be implementing a number of steps later this year that will ensure that safety and travel are synonymous. And so if you're asked the question, well, is it safe to fly, you can say that aviation safety continues. Aviation travel continues to be one of the safest ways to travel in this country and throughout the world. It was very interesting also to see the reception that we received in Europe concerning the devices we know as thermal neutron analysis, or TNA. These are the state-of-the-art explosive detection devices that the FAA has spent some $60 million in developing. The first device is scheduled to be installed at JFK Airport in July, and I was delighted when I was in London last week that the British Transport Minister and my good friend Paul Channon announced that the second device would go into the Gatwick Airport in Great Britain, and I suggest that we will have a number of those state-of-the-art devices installed in airports throughout Europe, because everywhere I went, I received a very good reception. What we hope to do working with these countries is take this state-of-the-art technology and advance it by light years if we can. We were discussing with the French transport minister the desire for the French to play a significant role in the development of technology. And I said, the United States of America is committed to having the best system in the world. And if the French scientists and engineers develop that system, we're going to put it in this country. And if we can develop that system jointly using the best brains and expertise in Great Britain, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, the United States, and Italy, and that ends up being a combined device, that's what we'll install. There is no room in this area for parochialism where it gets in the way of aviation security. I think we have a commitment to develop techniques and expertise and to develop the state of the art further than it is. One of the other areas that's of concern to many of you in this room who travel is the area of electronic devices. What do we do about electronic devices similar to the device that was used, it appears, to destroy Pan Am 103? Well, I have a boss that's pretty interested in this issue as well, the President of the United States. Everyone asked me, a reporter was in to see me today, about the decision-making process and was he really involved. And I said, all you have to do is look at his thirst for knowledge and his desire to make the best informed decision he can, is to look at the role he's played in getting everything and learning everything he can about what we're doing in the area of aviation security, in particular electronic devices. If we're going to work a program, and we're going to develop a program that's going to work in the area of electronic devices, it's got to work with other nations. We can't do one thing and have other nations do another and have a lack of consistency exist between one country and the other in the area of aviation travel. All of the governments I met with have agreed to work with us in developing a standard program for handling of these devices. A total ban on all such items is an option we have to consider, but there are a number of other options that we're seriously considering as well. We have to come up with a solution that makes sure that if these devices go on airplanes, they're safe, that they're not, a bomb is not inadvertently planted within one of those devices. And if it means a little extra time, I can assure you we will not compromise safety for the sake of expediency. This commitment, as you can tell, is a very serious thing with the Department of Transportation and with the President. It's the right thing to do. More importantly, it is something that has to be done. And finally, it also allows us to make sure that the families who are very concerned that the lives lost over Lockerbie are not lost in vain, that something good will come out of this tragedy. I am encouraged by the reception that I have received, and I am encouraged with the progress that we are making, but I remind you in the media that do not look for immediate results. We didn't solve hijacking on airplanes overnight. It took an extended effort by airlines, airport operators, and governments. But now we have a system that's safe from hijacking. I look forward to the day we'll have the same system for explosives. Exxon Valdez, the Alaskan oil spill, the most significant environmental disaster that this nation has ever faced. Another tragedy, a tragedy without the loss of life, but a tragedy just the same. And the question is, what is going to happen as a result of the disaster in Alaska? And I think the jury is still out. We can do two things. We can sit here and blame everybody, but I would only make the following observations. This spill is the largest spill in the history of the American oil industry. 10 million gallons of heavy crude went into the water within 3 hours. This tanker drove into a reef buried some 50 feet at 15 miles an hour. The tragedy, as bad as it is, could have been four times worse if the United States Coast Guard, working with Alaskan authorities, other military authorities, and the Exxon company, had not offloaded 40 million more gallons that was on this tanker in a very precarious state. Number two, there is no technology available in the world today that can handle a spill of this magnitude in the waters in Prince William Sound in early spring. What we've got to do is, number one, contain it and restore or create an environment this summer in Prince William Sound and further south that will let nature do its work. As the national coordinator to this effort, I can assure you that the President is totally committed to this. He recognizes the work, the wondrous work of nature. He wants us to make sure we're doing everything we can so nature can do its job. It is an important effort. It is not only important for Prince William Sound and for Alaska, it's important for this nation. At a time when we are becoming more and more energy dependent upon foreign governments for our energy, we have a crisis of major magnitude that threatens our ability to explore domestically the many sources within this country. The entire country, therefore, has a vested interest to see that the Valdez disaster is cleaned up immediately with minimum cost to the taxpayer. It is going to be a difficult problem. It is not easy. I leave for Alaska tomorrow to get another firsthand look at the progress to date. But the oil industry, Exxon, the state of Alaska, and the federal government must focus and will be focusing all summer on getting as much beach as possible cleaned up. Several thousand people are already working on this problem in Alaska, and that workforce will double or triple before the month of May is out. If we're able to restore Alaska to its natural environment, the oil industry will have demonstrated to the American people that they are capable of cleaning up their mess. If they don't, I think it will be very difficult for those oil companies and giants to develop domestic reserves. And therefore, at the same time that the Russians are running out of oil, the Chinese demands are growing, and the American demands are growing, we will find ourselves where the Arabs have a more dominant position in the market than they've ever had before, the Mideast countries. So therefore, it is important. It's important that we have the kind of commitment. It's important also that we learn from some of these things so that we can do everything we can to prevent this from happening again. We are virtually on the cutting edge of technology in Alaska today on how to deal with a spill of this magnitude. The expertise that we learned from this can be put, hopefully will not have to be put to use, but if it is necessary, it will be developed. And at the same time, the industry will be forced to develop contingency plans that make sense, that are financially sound, and work. That effort is ongoing. I am delighted to have the support not only of the President but of all parts of government in this responsibility, and I think you can be assured that significant progress is going to be made. Much of it will depend upon the weather and our ability to use the same kind of technology that took us to the moon and put it to work in Prince William Sound. But I want you to know that everything is being done. Eastern Airlines is obviously an issue that also came on, as we say in aviation, my radar screen. It's interesting to note that that decision, as controversial as it was at the time, that three-quarters of the American people supported the view of the President that labor management disputes should be resolved by negotiation between the parties, not by government intervention. You cannot create a harmonious relationship between labor and management through congressional act. It's got to be done by the parties. That poll, I think, recognizes, and it appeared in a no less distinguished a newspaper than the Washington Post, that poll indicates the American people understand that they don't believe the government should involve, and they don't want Congress determining how much they should be paid and what their working conditions are. It's interesting when that issue comes up and you ask a reporter or a news person whether they want their contract negotiated by Congress. I've yet to get a yes on that question. But I think it's indicative of a philosophy. One of the big problems for any cabinet officer is making sure we continue to look at the forest instead of the trees. The President said in my swearing in, some say Sam is a global thinker. I said to him, Mr. President, did you say I'm a global thinker? And he said, no, I didn't say that. He said, some people say you are. Well, I hope to prove by the time I finish my term as Secretary of Transportation that I am a global thinker and that I can see the forest for the trees. And the forest that we're looking at is the development of our national transportation policy, my highest priority. What this is an assessment and the development of a program that will meet our transportation needs for the 21st century. This process is already underway. It will be developed with the assistance of industry, scientists, environmentalists, and strategic planners. It is something that is absolutely essential if we can get this policy put together and we can get support from the administration and get support from the Congress and get support from the industry, we will be able to put in place a program for the rebuilding of our nation's infrastructure and the development of our transportation system. This is absolutely essential to our country's economic vitality and for our national defense. There's no question we have the best transportation system in the world. But the 40-year phase of building our nation's basic transportation infrastructure is drawing to a close. The system of interstates is basically complete. We have a good network of waterways and airports and the finest air traffic control system in the world. And as Insight indicated today, a revitalized railroad system. But our transportation system is only as good as our policies for improvement. We have an infrastructure problem in this country that is staggering. It is not exciting or sexy to talk about infrastructure. No one wants to go home and say, what did you do for lunch? Oh, I heard this fascinating speaker. He spoke on infrastructure. But it's as important as anything we're doing. It controls our life. It will control the future of our economic system. And it is something we depend on and take for granted. Well, don't take it for granted anymore. You can't take it for granted. It's got to be rebuilt, and it's got to be rebuilt across the board. And that's going to require a lot of money and a lot of effort. And it's all areas. We have highways, we have bridges, we have mass transportation. In Chicago alone, we did an estimate of our infrastructure for mass transit. We came to the conclusion, working with experts, that we had $13 billion infrastructure, and there were $6 billion worth of needs between now and the year 25. It's imperative if we're going to deal with this problem, that we start now. The Federal Highway Administration estimates there's a need for an additional 11 to 15,000 lane miles for interstate highways. Through the year 2005, the total backlog of accrued bridge needs on the federal aid system could be as much as $72 billion. New highway construction is required, new bridge construction is required, expansion of capacity is required. Traditionally, the federal government has played a significant role in this, but that role is changing. And I think what you're going to see is the local commitment to infrastructure rebuilding on highways, bridges, airports, and et cetera, is going to be increased, and we're going to be looking for better ways to pay for this cost of rebuilding. Private sector, the people that use the system, will be required to pay. And finally, we're going to see increased use of user fees. All of this, however, is an indication that we have a lot to do in a short period of time to do it, and right now, no plan that everybody signed off on to get there. Now you know why this is so important. Now you know why this is the legacy that George Bush and I want to leave as part of this administration. And now you know why the people working on that within the Department of Transportation have basically a blank check in that regard. I would make a couple other comments and then entertain any questions you might have. We also have to deal with safety on the highways. The Department of Transportation is very proud of our safety belt program. We've gone from 10% safety belt use in the 1980s to over 46% today. We estimate that increased safety belt use has saved an estimated 11,000 lives in the last 5 years. All new cars produced after September 1, 1989 will be equipped with either an airbag or automatic safety belts. Child safety belt laws are in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. As a result of our effort to get the drinking age raised to 21 in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, teenage fatalities attributable to alcohol are down 34%. There's another area we have to deal with, though, and that's the area of drugs. Since January of 87, for example, there have been over 60 major rail incidents in which one or more key employees tested positive for illegal drug use. Illegal drug use is at epidemic proportions. It requires all of us to address this at the very top priority, and we are doing so. I am proud that the Department of Transportation has the most effective, comprehensive, random drug testing program in government. I am proud that my name appears in a leading case approving drug testing in selected cases. And I would like nothing better than to have my name on a case issued by the Supreme Court approving random drug testing for safety-related jobs across the board. I find a great deal of support within industry for that. I find a great deal of support within the administration and with the American people. And it does work. Let me give you just one number. The Coast Guard began random drug testing, as all military organizations did, approximately 5 years ago. And the percentage of those testing positive dropped from 10.3% when the program began in 83 to 2.9% last year. This is an indication that it does work. It's a deterrent to use. And instead of just concentrating on what we're doing about the supply of narcotics, we also must work on the demand side. As a former prosecutor who's been involved in drug prosecutions for longer than I'd like to admit, I recognize we must have a multifaceted approach, and I'm encouraged that the administration and the department will be in the leadership. And as I indicated to Bill Bennett, there are two people that have blank checks on the resources of the department. One is the group that's working on our national transportation policy, and the other is the drug czar, Bill Bennett, one of the most thankless jobs in government. He walked into my office, and I said to him, Bill, what do you need? How can we help you? You are the president's point man. I know what it's like to be a point man. Everybody in government has to support you, and I'm here to totally support you, and I urge you to support him as well. Finally, something that we can end up on that I think you'll understand and understand very well, and that's the area of domestic aviation safety. what are we going to do about the crowded airways within our own state? One of the interesting side benefits of the trip to Europe was I got an opportunity to fly in the environment and to listen to the controllers in Europe. I won't publicly identify the country, but I'll indicate to you that there was no question in my mind as I listened to the various countries and the air traffic control systems that the president of Lufthansa was absolutely right when he told me, you have the best air traffic control system in the world. And while you may have faults, he said, I wish all of my European counterparts would come to the United States and take that system and put it to work in Europe. So let's not assume, because the workforce is in the process of being rebuilt, that we have a second-rate system. We must keep it first-rate. I don't know if any of you have been to a control tower or to a radar room, but if you get a chance, do it. It's, one, in my opinion, one of the toughest jobs in government. You have life and death decisions that you must make every day on the radar screen, and one mistake can mean a disaster, and you must do that for 8 hours a day. I've met with probably 300 to 400 controllers all over the country. I've talked to them. I've watched them. I've listened to them. I'm convinced that the new workforce that's been created by the FAA is first-rate, doing a first-rate job, and what we've got to do is support them, whether it's in pay demonstration programs, expansion of equipment, building new systems, because capacity in our system is stretched. Travel will grow at the rate of 4.4% annually, we need to have adequate airport and air traffic capacity, and that is a matter we are committed to. Needless to say, our agenda is busy. It's exciting. It's different. We've put together a team of some outstanding professionals, both from within the Beltway and without. They are from all walks of life. But they, as I, are committed to making our transportation system a little bit better. I wish we had, however, a few less crises over the next several months so we can do something about some of the other things we're dealing with. With that in mind, I'll be glad. I guess they've been lining up the questions here. And I know a couple of the people who submitted questions because they were kind of telling me before what they were going to ask me to get a first-hand. Are these the ones here I'm supposed to take? Well, these are your notes. Here, all right. Yeah. All right. So I think the part it might be to entertain some questions. I can't believe you all submitted questions like that.
Who will pay for the increased airport security? Passengers in the form of a ticket tax, airlines, or the government?
This probably comes. See, now the question is, the great Carnac is now going to say, who submitted this question? The great Carnac guesses the ATA. We believe the users who benefit from the system should pay for the increased technology. They have the ability to impose a security fee. It's really relatively small compared to the cost of air travel and well worth it. And we believe those funds that are generated through that security tariff is what should be used to pay for these. We believe it's as much. We've paid $60 million to develop the technology. We now think it's time for the passenger and the user to do his share. So that's where we are on that issue.
How long will it be before the TNA devices are available in American airports?
The great Carnac couldn't possibly guess who wrote this question. But the great Carnac suggests that it'll be in July. It'll be July at JFK will be the first device. The second, thanks to the cooperation of my counterpart in the United Kingdom, will be in Gatwick sometime shortly thereafter. And they hopefully will have them in Europe and the United States, a number of them, before the next year is out.
Will the CIA and NSA be more actively involved in alerting aviation authorities to terrorist threats?
Intelligence gathering is an important part of any anti-terrorism program. it is something that requires international cooperation. If you're going to properly assess threats and disseminate the information to thwart threats, you must have the cooperation of the governments and countries that you're involved in. They have, in many cases, the best sources of intelligence gathering, and the CIA, American intelligence gathering organizations, the FAA, and those foreign country intelligence organizations must work together. There's a commitment to work together. The system needs improving. We're in the process of improving it. I have every reason to believe, because the President of the United States has indicated to General Scowcroft that he wants complete and full cooperation within the intelligence communities within the United States, that that will happen. I also believe, from my visits to Europe, that the foreign governments also believe that. Now, let's talk about dissemination. Probably a question in here on this, but I'll get to it before it comes out. Why don't you tell everybody about every threat? First of all, if we were to disclose confidential intelligence information on every threat, we would basically dry up the sources of intelligence, because lives would be at stake. Number two, if we disclosed the information publicly, the terrorist would go somewhere else, and we would have no advance notice of where they're going. So instead of going with airline X, they'd go to airline Y within a few minutes' notice, and we would have no ability. Number three, you don't stop them if you let them know you're looking for them. You take steps to catch them and deter them. Number four, there are hundreds of false and bogus threats that are received every year. And if we were to broadcast those, people would take them for granted, so that when we seriously have a threat that we need to disseminate to the American people and to people traveling on airlines in and from this country, it has to be credible. And it won't be credible if there's hundreds of them out there. People will take them for granted, they'll ignore them, and then when there's a real one, they won't be able to separate the wheat from the chaff.
You mentioned a possible ban on video cassette recorders, laptop computers, and the like. What is the status of rulemaking, or do you plan to proceed with such a rule?
The great Carnac says that maybe President Bush sent this question, because he asked me this question all the time. We're trying to get an agreement between the countries of Europe, the ECAC organization, and our own. If we can get, it's a very difficult problem to deal with. I think you recognize how many reporters and how reliant we've become on electronic devices. And it's important that we develop a program that works, and that it work consistent with other countries. It's very hard to ban them coming out of the United States if they're not banned coming in by foreign governments who have a lot to say about what goes on in their own country, and rightly so. I'm encouraged that we're coming close to a policy in that regard that we think will be effective. But it's something that's going to evolve. And the long-range answer is to develop the technology that allow us to use TNA-type technology with the luggage that goes into the cargo hold, and to use vapor or some other kind of detection for explosives at the passenger screening. But it's going to require an all-out effort. Also, the great Carnac says that Bob Hager from NBC could have asked this question, too.
Any plans to work with the cruise industry to improve counterterrorism?
Well, the problems of terrorism are not related just to aviation. One of the things that struck home when you go to Europe is how aware they are of terrorism. I mean, they've been affected by, Italy, been very affected by terrorism in a number of areas. In meeting with the Italian authorities, the security that was provided on a regular basis indicates that it's not isolated. Right now, we are exploring all aspects of security. Aviation security at this point appears to be because of the top priority, because there is no real remedy. If an airline is blown up by a 2-pound package of plastique, there's no recover. There's no, as we used to say, in the computer business, graceful degradation. It's over. So our major efforts are on that, but if we have to move into the maritime area, we will.
The Exxon cleanup plan will leave over 200 miles of Alaskan shoreline uncleansed. Will the Coast Guard find this partial cleanup acceptable?
Well, we received the plan yesterday on time. It's being assessed right now by Admiral Yost, who's in Alaska with Vice Admiral Robbins. I will be departing with a group from the White House and the Department of Transportation, Coast Guard, and the Congress tomorrow. When we arrive in Alaska, the first thing we'll do is assess that plan. My position is that you can't do enough. If it's anywhere close to being a viable option, we ought to do it. There are some 300 miles to be cleaned up. Some of it, nature will do its work. And one of the interesting experiences we learned from the Amoco Cadiz, ironic, in France a number of years ago, is that the cleanup people did more damage to the environment than if the conditions had been left for nature to do its work. So that's why when you see that there's disputes between Exxon and the conservationists in Alaska, it's because they're very concerned that the steps taken are really taken, are steps that should be taken to restore the environment, not further destroy it. And when you're dealing in an area that's remote, that has a lot of nature at work, you want to make sure you don't cross the line. My guess is that Exxon will be making additional changes to their plan as we review it, that the real effort will begin sometime. I mean, there's already, when I say real effort, I mean the effort will be enhanced significantly. As I said, there's already several thousand people working in Alaska right now. As an aside, the economy of Alaska is going to receive an injection into Alaska of anywhere from $100 to $500 million this summer. So that's five times what the fishing industry's annual income is. And I might add, all of that's going to be paid for by the oil industry.
It's been 6 months since DOT's blood alcohol rules for truck drivers were issued. Is the machinery in place to enforce, and what effect has it had?
I asked my Deputy Secretary of Transportation this question. She's working on it. Elaine Chao, the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, is working on all of these programs. I'm not convinced that the enforcement mechanism is totally in place.
It's been 6 months since DOT's blood alcohol rules for truck drivers were issued. Is the machinery in place to enforce, and what effect has it had?
I asked my Deputy Secretary of Transportation this question. She's working on it. Elaine Chao, the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, is working on all of these programs. I'm not convinced that the enforcement mechanism is totally in place for our drug rules. One of the problems is that many of our rules on drugs have been held up because we're now the defendant in some 30 lawsuits. When you're confirmed for the Senate, you have to list all the lawsuits you're a defendant in. I hope I'm never nominated again, because I'm going to need a computer and a staff of five to list all the cases I'm listed in my official capacity as Secretary of Transportation. I believe that program is ongoing. I don't think it's yet in place, but I anticipate it will be shortly.
Yesterday, an ICC commissioner is quoted as saying that the Staggers Act should be modified. What is your position on Staggers and efforts to modify it?
Great Carnac says. it appears that the ICC process, the Interstate Commerce Commission process, is not proceeding at a pace that is satisfactory to the industry and to Congress. I believe that Staggers was a very, very good improvement. I think Insight Magazine, I don't want to plug one particular magazine, but Insight Magazine will probably affirm that the growth and the return of capital into the rail industry in this country is a direct result of deregulation. On the other hand, there are people in this country that are captive shippers that rely and can only have one mode of transportation. That's especially true in the area of grains, in the area of coal. Those people, those shippers, and the consumers who they work with have an absolute right to make sure that the legal mechanism that's in place is working. And so I think before we modify staggers, we ought to get all the steps in place and all the funding necessary to make it work. I'm sure the commission is attempting to do that. I'm certainly going to do everything I can to expedite that process. But I think the idea of rate cases taking 3 to 5 years is wrong. I might add, as Secretary of Transportation, I asked them to give me a list of all the rules in the Department of Transportation that are 3 or more years old. 290 approximately rules in the Department of Transportation have been hanging around for 3 to 7 years. We have a program to expedite those rules. Many of them are moot now, and it's important. If government's going to work and this rulemaking process is going to work, it works expeditiously. And we are committed to making it work expeditiously. I'm sure the commission is committed to work to make it work expeditiously, and then we ought to look at staggers.
Do you favor total deregulation of the trucking industry?
I think deregulation of all industries has had a significant impact. I think trucking at this particular point has benefited significantly from deregulation. I think the consumers have benefited. In aviation, I don't have a trucking number, but in aviation, the result of airline deregulation is estimated by economists, not working for the department, but independent economists, to have developed a benefit to the American consumer of $100 billion. So when you talk about airfares and talk about where they're going, recognize that we've been in the deregulation environment for a period of years, and the American consumer has benefited by billions and billions of dollars. We've got to keep that going. I think that is one of the major reasons the economy has gone on so long in such a healthy condition. And I don't think we want to do anything to stop it. I don't think we want to go back. I don't see any great sentiment to go back. I think we want to make sure we've settled down with the regulated environment that we have now before we push it much further. But it certainly is an option we ought to be looking at.
Would you counsel President Bush to reject a gasoline tax increase for deficit reduction, even at the cost of winning a capital gains tax modification?
Should I, Great Carnac wonders, should he tell this group what he'd tell the president if he asked him that question? The answer is, Carnac says, don't answer this question. But let me tell you where I stand on deficit reduction using the gasoline tax. I think the gasoline tax is an important option that can be looked at in the future, primarily at the state and local level, for infrastructure rebuilding. And if, in fact, we use the gas tax, and I'm against any taxes, as you know, if we use the gas tax at the federal level to reduce deficit, we are depriving state and local governments of their opportunity to use that for infrastructure rebuilding, and I'm against it.
Should gasoline taxes continue to be earmarked for the Highway Trust Fund alone?
Yes.
You mentioned user fees to finance rebuilding the nation's highways. Does this violate Mr. Bush's pledge against no new taxes?
Well, when I talk about user fees, I talk about toll highway fees, I talk about state and local gas taxes, I talk about state and local developer fees. You've never heard me advocate an increase in the federal gas tax, federal excise tax, federal income tax, federal duck stamp tax for deficit reduction, for infrastructure, or anything else. I am a great lip reader. No new taxes.
What do you plan to do to break up the stranglehold of major airlines at some hub airports? Do you favor re-regulation of fares?
This assumes, as a lawyer who used to practice law, this assumes a fact, not an evidence. The use of the word stranglehold, I challenge. What are we going to do about the problems of limited capacity at airports throughout the United States and the impact it has on deregulation? We have a major study, what I call the competition study. We have to do everything we can to enhance competition in the airline industry. We have to do everything we can consistent with national policy to make sure that no one airline or company monopolizes a market. We have a number of options that we're looking at. My guess is we'll be pretty progressive in that area, subject to approval by OMB and other regulatory authorities. But I do not believe it is in the best interest of the American consumer in a deregulated environment to have any one shipper, airline, maritime user, or anybody else capture a share of the market and have capacity stop, or the lack of capacity stop, somebody from coming in. That's why tomorrow I'm going to Denver, and we're going to talk about a new airport in Denver. That's why throughout this country, the week after next on National Transportation Week, we're going to go talk about expanding the capacity. That's the long-range solution. More airports, more gates, more equipment to expand the capacity of our existing system. At the same time, we've got to make sure we're doing everything in the short long line to make sure we're enhancing competition. So I think you'll see we'll be taking and looking at many of the decisions we make with an elimination of the, quote, stranglehold, unquote, phenomena in mind.
Do you favor increasing the fuel economy standard beyond the current 27.5 miles per gallon?
The great Carnac says this question came from Seth Payne. The great Carnac is quite sure this question came from Seth Payne. We'll be making a decision on the fuel economy or the CAFE standard soon. Actually, I think Seth Payne's question would be, are you going to keep it at 27.5? First of all, we have a decision that we're in the process of making as to whether we should keep it at 27.5 or reduce it. That decision will be made shortly. Everybody has quoted me or has indicated to me through various sources, including Business Week, as to what I've recommended and what I'm going to do. I haven't acknowledged that yet publicly. I think I'll wait till I make a decision, and then we'll let you know what it is.
When will the recommendations proposed by the Denton Commission on Merchant Marine and Defense be implemented, and what effects will they have in the short and long term?
Well, this deals with the whole issue of the role of the maritime industry in our transportation network. You know, every war we've been involved in, we have used the merchant marine to transport most of our resources to foreign soil. We do not have the airlift capability to move a major military organization for an extended period of time to Europe or to other parts of the world. We have to decide what role the maritime industry is going to play in national defense. The Denton Commission deals with many of those issues. They are on the radar screen for the National Transportation Policy Group, and I anticipate that they'll be part of our report, which we hope we'll have done by the end of the year.
Before asking my final question, I see that time is up. I'd like to present you with a Press Club Certificate of Appreciation that is underneath the podium.
Do I have to declare this on my conflict of interest statement?
It's not edible. And here is a Press Club paperweight.
This I do have to declare. Thank you very much, man. Oh, very nice. I have to get it appraised and declare it, but thank you very much.
My final question is, after an agenda of Eastern Airlines, Valdez oil spills, and fuel economy controversies, any plans to run for the governor of Illinois?
The great Carnac says that Governor Jim Thompson did not submit this question. Well, the state of Illinois has a great governor, as many of you know. You know, all of us are where we are today because of people. When young people come to me and they say, I want to do it on my own, and I don't want your help, I say, well, you know, that's, I understand that pride. Maybe that's Hoosier pride. But frankly, most of us, even if you do a good job, need to be recognized by someone and encouraged by someone. My mentor, I have three mentors who have really helped my career the most. One is, I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, and as corny as this sound, I was an Eagle Scout and walked in Lincoln's footsteps. And though he was dead for many years, being around the Lincoln legend in Springfield, Illinois, brought home public service and the importance and the satisfaction of it. The second mentor is the current governor of the state of Illinois, the longest sitting governor, a man who is one of my dearest friends in the whole world, who I think will go down in history as one of the great governors of this nation after 14 years. If Jim Thompson wants to run for governor of Illinois, he'll have my full support. If he wants after 14 years to go do something else, he'll have my full support. As I've told people before, I have a third mentor. That's the man I consider to be the finest man I've ever met in government, George Bush, and I've known him for 10 years. He is the most unassuming, decent human being I've ever met in this business, and there are not many of them. He's asked me to do a mission. He's the reason I'm here. Governor Thompson, you talked about who supported me. Governor Thompson, much to my surprise, well, somewhat surprise, the day after the election announced to the world that I'd make a great Secretary of Transportation. But that's the kind of cheerleader Governor Jim Thompson has been for me. That's the kind of cheerleader that George Bush has been for me. I don't want to let them down. I don't want to let the American people down. So I'm here for the duration, however long that is, as Secretary of Transportation, and elective office is not an option I have considered or would consider in the future. I think the job I got is plenty enough, and let's just hope we can get out of here with our skin intact. Your commission says, it's very interesting, I've had several presidential commissions, but they all say for a period of time. This one says, for a length of period determined by the president. So I have no term, but I assume he's going to keep me around a little bit longer. So as long as I'm here, I'm going to try to do a job for him and the American people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Secretary Skinner.
You've been listening to another in a series of programs from the National Press Club. Today's guest speaker was Samuel Skinner, Secretary of Transportation. For cassettes of today's Press Club broadcast with Secretary of Transportation Samuel Skinner, call toll-free 800-253-0808. The number to call for cassettes of today's Press Club broadcast and for the NPR cassette catalog is toll-free 800-253-0808 or 608-263-4892. Our technical director is Michael Cullen with help from Stacy Abbott. Special thanks to Greg Bacon at the National Press Club. In Washington, I'm John Ogolnik.
Support for this program is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include Novo Nordisk, serving bioindustrial and medical markets worldwide. For Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation. National Journal, publisher of the Almanac of American Politics. And Software AG, worldwide supplier of advanced information management solutions. This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or the broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.